Good afternoon. Welcome to the afternoon session. I'd like to thank the LAC and the Educational Council and various other people for inviting me to this conference. I think it's kind of pleasant to be at a monastery for a quiet weekend like this, since this time next week, my two grandchildren will be sending me for 2 weeks to keep me busy. So this will be a nice quiet weekend to recover from that. We're going to... We're going to talk about laminated shielding for primary and secondary barriers. And as an overview, we're going to talk about briefly the shielding properties. We all know those. Lead and concrete primary barriers for high energy. We'll talk about the implications for secondary barriers and spend some time on practical considerations, a bit about composite doors, escape hatches, and a final thing about source constraints. This is the a table I usually present for the shielding materials. We're only concerned about, in this case, concrete, lead, and steel, and it has those properties that you can see there. And is the table of the TVLs for those materials, shown in NCRP 151 for both the primary and for the leakage. Note that this for 90 degrees, the leakage not necessarily for in the near forward direction at 30 or 45 degrees. There is no data for that published in this report. Note also that, of course, we now see two TVLs, as Raymond pointed out this morning, for both the primary and the leakage radiation, which is a better fit to the data, which is shown in NCRP 51. So the rationale for laminated shielding is that there are many facilities which were built in the 60s, which housed cobalt-60 or 4MV single-energy machines. And then suddenly, 15 years later or so, they suddenly want to buy a dual-energy machine, which is going to be 6 and 10 or even 6 and 18. And you've got an existing facility, so what are you going to do? You have to add some more shielding, and this is probably the easiest way to do it. Also, remodeling existing facilities where space is limited. Even when new facilities, they put constraints on the amount of space you have. In big cities like Mass General, for example, we have a limited amount of space for putting in new vaults, and there's a constraint on that too. If one goes this route, then one needs a high density, high Z material, but one has to worry for high energies about photoneutron production and capture gamma rays. So let's look at a general simple geometry for laminated shielding. In this case, we have a beam coming in this direction, and we're either going to have lead or we could have steel. For a thickness X, we've got an overall thickness T, and the concrete thickness is just T minus X. Now, in many cases, I have found, in my experience, that there's often a limit on the thickness of material that the architects or the situation dictates. Typically, a ceiling might be where you'd find a restriction because of matching floors in other parts of the building or other buildings. So you might have only about 4 feet of thickness to work with for a 15 or 18 MV beam. It also is true in walls as well, because we find that the architect says, look, this is a small facility, I'm giving you 4 feet, and you see what you can do with it. Well, you can do it, of course, but it's nice to have the greater distance and the luxury of the space. And again, I'll come back to that a little later when I discuss in detail our facility, our new facility. So if you have just the lead and the concrete, and you do the calculations, determine the total number of TVLs you need, you can write down two simple equations for the thickness and number of TVLs for each component, and you can solve this. There's a unique solution to this problem, and so then you can determine how much lead and how much concrete you need, given the various p-values and so forth, and W that Raymond mentioned this morning. And you solve those equations, you get something like this. So that's pretty straightforward. However, life under NCRP 51 is not quite so simple, because now we have two TVLs for concrete. Thanks heavens we don't have two for lead. And so the equation becomes this, where you have the first TVL and then the subsequent TVLs. And so the solution to this equation becomes this, a little more complex but manageable. Again, a unique solution. But if lead is the first material, which is very frequently the case when you retrofit a room with a lead inside on the walls, then this reduces to this because as long as the lead thickness is greater than one TVL, you don't have to worry about the subsequent concrete TVLs. And the solution is essentially the same as before, except you've changed this parameter over here. So let's look at an example. I mentioned before we have a maximum thickness of 48 inches, or 122 centimeters, and suppose that we have a workload of 750 gray per week, a distance of 7 meters to the point of interest. A U factor, as given this morning by Ray, was 0.213 for a lateral field, an occupancy of 1, a P of 0.02 millisieverts per week. You then calculate the N sub T is 5.2, and so if we take a 15 MV X-ray beam, ignoring for the moment neutrons, with these TVLs, then you end up with N sub L is 14.7 centimeters, or 5.8 inches of lead, and consequently the thickness of the concrete is 42.2. So clearly you'll round up to 6 and round this down to 42. So that gives you a way to calculate the thickness that you need. However, the majority of radiotherapy units sold today are dual energy machines, and virtually all radiotherapy centers use a mix of photon energies. Particularly, for example, if you use IMRT, and I think the majority of people use 6 MV for IMRT, we certainly do, then the majority of MU delivered could be at low energy. So you have to, as Ray pointed out this morning, there's a long equation for W times U, and for your use, your department, or for each machine in your department, you have to calculate separate W times U factors to make sure that you're adequately covered. As an example of what changes, at MGH we had a 18 MV LINAC, and the use prior to IMRT, which was used for treating prostate patients, so it was 3D conformal therapy for the most part, was 20% low energy, 6 MV, and 80% high energy. That was the typical GYN prostate cases. Once we'd started doing IMRT and that load rose to 28%, then the use changed from 70% 6 MV to 30% 18 MV. So there's a changing thing here. So when you plan for a new department and you're doing this a new built new facility, you do have to take this thing into account very carefully. So if you want to do some calculations for the mixed energy beams, then it becomes more complicated because you have two terms. You're summing up the p-values for the 6 and the 10 in this case, and you've got two separate terms here. Now, this is not easily analytically soluble. If you just remove one of the terms and go back to the first term here, for example, then this just reduces to the equations we saw earlier. So it's very a simple formula. And you can solve this by doing it iteratively, just changing x until you get the right answer. Or you can do the usual technique of just calculate each one separately and determine how much more you need. If it's less than one TVL, you add one half value layer, which is a standard technique. And we did that exercise and found that it gave fairly good agreement in both cases. You can do what we did, take the alternative approach of using only the highest energy to calculate the primary and the mixed energy to calculate the leakage at 90 degrees. So the primary is primarily for the high energy, and the leakage, which is dominated by the IMRT, is the low energy. So the rationale is that this represents the worst case for both the primary and the low energy leakage case. So if we go back to the same example, if we have the same maximum barrier thickness of 48 inches for the primary barrier, and now we have the high energy is 225 gray per week with 525 gray for the lower energy, with the same parameters for the rest of the equation, then we can calculate 5 inches for the lead thickness, which is somewhat less than we saw before, about an inch less, and an inch more of this. So we can get away with less lead, but you have to be sure that the numbers you're choosing, the input numbers, make a lot of sense. One doesn't want to find, after you've built it, that the mix of patients and so forth has radically changed. All right? Now, shielding doesn't frequently become a problem for secondary barriers, but if it happens to be the case when one's retrofitting, and I'll give an example in a moment, if you need to do that, then bear in mind a few things. There are two TVLs for scattered radiation and lead, and the leakage TVLs are, strictly speaking, only for 90 degrees, so one has to be cautious about that. And of course, there are no scattered TVLs for steel. So if one's looking at angles of 30 degrees or even less, just outside the primary, you want to consider both the leakage and the scatter. Then you've got to go through this kind of system here. And given that with the IMRT, the leakage might become more dominant than it usually is in that equation, where normally the scatter becomes a major factor. And for the 90-degree barrier, only, as I said before, only leakage is important, particularly if the IMRT is a consideration. Now, question is, does the obliquity factor, which is, misspelling there, apply to scattered radiation? Interestingly, the NCRP 49 discusses the obliquity factor for primary radiation, but makes no mention of either scatter or leakage radiation. NCRP does the same thing, except in the example section, it specifically mentions that it should not be used for scattered radiation, primarily because the source is now not a point source, as for example, the beam from the primary beam from the target, but is a kind of a diffuse source in the patient, and therefore the angles subtended by that beam are not precisely known, and therefore you could err on the wrong side by choosing a large angle where a more narrow angle might be appropriate, which would then give you a higher amount of scatter radiation. So we set out to look at this using a Monte Carlo program. We took the data from Sheikh Bagheri and Rogers for the beam spectra for the whole bunch of Varian machines. And what we found was that the magenta shows the NCRP 51 recommendations, and the blue points represent the Monte Carlo results, and the red represents the magenta times the cosine 30, and this is for 18 MVM concrete. And you can see there's a fairly good agreement between the for the use of the obliquity factor. It does change quite a bit in this region here, but it seems to adhere to the 30-degree factor quite well. We also did it for other materials. We can't make a comparison with steel because they don't exist, of course. But we did it for lead. And again, you can see that it agrees reasonably well with the NCRP 151 times cosine of 30. I think there was only one energy where it was slightly different, and it may well be that the spectrum was perhaps somewhat different for the Monte Carlo case compared with the number that's been used for the in NCRP 151. But in any case, at large depths, they still agrees pretty well. So we had looked at energies from 4 up to 18 MV. So where does this come into play? I call this a re-retrofit. We had a treatment room which began operating with a cobalt 60 way back when. It was a 780 with a beam stopper. And this unit was replaced with a 4MV Linac about 1990, which with no beam stopper. So that required a significant amount of lead to provide the extra shielding. And that was on three walls and a ceiling, the fourth wall being facing the outside, so it didn't need any extra shielding. It's now currently being replaced with a 6MV machine, so we have to go back again and add even more concrete. So the first room was essentially only regular density concrete around it, and the first added lead on three walls plus the ceiling. And now the current change is to add additional lead to allow for the 6MV. And now, the point about this is that not that you can't calculate, but you have to be, it's very tedious and very difficult to go through this because you've got now three components here. You've got the two existing ones and a third one. And if you're comparing, for example, the scatter and the leakage, you have to sort of take it into account very, very carefully. So you have to sort of do the calculation carefully, but it's kind of lengthy. It's not a simple calculation you'd normally do with a single barrier material. And you do have to take that into account. It's just a little advisory. Now, at high energies, the neutrons have to be shielded against as well as photons. And for concrete wall, this generally represents no problem. But for laminated barriers, the sufficiency of the concrete barrier to protect against neutrons needs to be examined. It may be that you put enough lead in, you haven't got enough concrete to... enough concrete to suffice to correct for the neutrons from the head of the machine. So you have two sources, the photons and the primary and the neutrons. So now we go back to the equations again, and we've added this thing here where the it's just an identity saying the neutron TVLs is equal to the concrete stuff here. But and the other equation is essentially the same in terms of the number of TVLs for photons and the total thickness. The thing here is only that the thickness of concrete material for neutrons is less than that required for the neutron leakage from that machine. As long as that's the case, then everything's fine. If it's not, then you must do something in addition. So what you have to do is maybe add some polyethylene. So you've got a third factor in this equation here. And again, you have the same identity that you have to make sure that the neutron thickness is less than the required amount. In addition to neutrons from the head of the machine and photons leakage, we also have to consider photon neutron production in the lead and subsequent production of captured gamma rays. I say here the greater the thickness of lead, I'll come back to that in a moment, but in general, there'll be more neutrons coming out and the captured gamma rays. The magnitude of the effect will also depend on how much concrete is placed after the lead. I'll come to that also in a moment. For walls, it's very easy to install the lead on the upstream side, since the lead can be installed in a kind of self-supporting manner. It needs to be braced, of course, but it can be installed in a simple manner. So the diagram I showed earlier where the lead is on the inside is easy to do. For ceilings, this is not true, because in order to put the lead up there, you need a concrete base to support it, and that's typically about 18 inches, maybe a bit less, depends on the size of the room and what the structural engineer thinks. It also doesn't apply to situations where you might have two high-energy rooms with a joined wall, a common wall, and they're facing each other, so their primary beams are pointing at each other, in which case then you need to center the material inside the concrete barrier. So this is a generic situation where we have, first of all, concrete, and then some lead, and then some additional concrete. So the photon comes in, produces a neutron, and then subsequently can produce a captured gamma ray. So we have these extra components to worry about in addition to the photons and the neutrons from the head. So this is the standard equation shown in NCRP 151. It's due to Pat McGinley. H is the neutron dose equivalent produced by the photons striking the lead, and D0 is the incident photon X-ray dose in the same units per second. And R is a production rate, which we'll go into in a moment, depending on the energy and the material. And F max is just the beam size at isocenter. Note that the value of H in the equation is a balance between attenuation of the incoming photons, that's the first exponential term here, and the attenuation of neutrons, which is the second term here. So there's a balance here in terms of how much you can reduce the neutrons. Ideally, you want to make the first thickness as low as possible to make sure you capture all of the neutrons. To account for captured gamma rays, NCRP 151 recommends using a factor of 2.7 for the photon component. So to allow for the production of captured gamma rays, we say that the total dose equivalent is the neutrons plus the photons, and the photons is expressed as the transmitted photon intensity, which is the photons without consideration of captured gamma rays, times a conservative factor of 2.7, I think Ray pointed out again out this morning in his talk. So what you have now is you have to do a calculation taking into account, first of all, the photon transmission and the neutron transmission, and then you have to add on that the production of neutrons and the production of more photons. So it's a fairly complex process. So the way you can do this is you first of all calculate the lead and concrete thickness required for stopping the photons and neutrons in the existing in the proposed barrier, and then you determine the dose equivalent for photoneutrons, determine the overall photon dose, and then you sum the two, and this presumably will be greater than the 0.02. You then go back and you scale everything down to the 0.02 and then recalculate to make sure that with the new values of thicknesses and so forth, the total, including all the four components, is no greater than 0.02. And they should be able to do that in one cycle. Interestingly, a recent piece of work by Newman and Asadi Zaidabadi have used a linear programming technique which optimizes the cost of laminated shielding subject to dose and or thickness constraints. So they take all these factors into account, and you can input any numbers you want, your thickness, materials, and so forth, and it'll optimize any two parameters so you can determine what the optimum thicknesses are using their program. interestingly found that steel was a cheaper laminate than lead, which is kind of contrary to what I would have thought and what people popularly do. But that depends, and it includes, by the way, construction costs in that program. So that's kind of interesting that they can do this kind of optimization. And you can, of course, fix the thickness, or you can fix the external dose too. And interesting, going back on to what Gary Miller said yesterday, we had a discussion meeting with our contractor for the new building, and he was telling us that, well, you know, until a short while ago, the cost of lead was only about 70 cents a pound or so. And I remember back when it was like 10 cents a pound. But very recently, it's climbed up to, he said, greater than $1.75 a pound. He claims that the shortage due to major mine closure in Australia and reduced exports of lead from China because they need more for internal consumption. So the price of lead's going up, so it makes the cost of doing business in lead, as Gary said, a lot more expensive. And linear accelerators are much more lead-hungry than diagnostic rooms, and so this is obviously of some concern. But it's an interesting point, bearing in mind what the other authors found out about optimization of cost. Going back a little on to photoproduction, these are the primary reactions in terms of those materials, either photons on lead or these lead components here. And these are the threshold energies. So what we found, we did some Monte Carlo studies. We found, of course, there is no production on iron at 10 MV, for example, because it's below the threshold. We were able to, of course, do it for higher energies and also for all energies at lead. So this some work done by my friend David Geiger, and this shows the neutron production on a block of lead from 18 MV, and it shows that the neutron fluence spectra as a function of thickness, the energy of the neutrons for various thicknesses of lead. And you can see a few cm, about 5 cm is kind of optimal for, is actually the highest production rate, if you will, for neutron photoproduction. And that shows here as a function of slab thickness. Again, it's the same data also from David. And you can see the fluence peaks at about 5 cm or so and then drops off. And you can see the energy dependency here quite strongly. But again, there was no production at 10 MV. If you go to the NCRP 151, the recommended values, the R values, are these. So for the highest is for lead at 18 MV, and we give 19. Well, that should be microsieverts. I didn't change the font size there. Microsieverts per centigrade per meter squared. For steel at 18 MV, it's about a factor of 10 lower. And lead at 15 is also about a factor of 5 or 6 lower than the value at 18. And if you take the ratios of those, either for 18 ratio of lead over iron, or in terms of lead 18 over 15, you get these ratios. And from a Monte Carlo, we haven't completed the studies, but looking at the fluence only, we get something lower than that. But as I say, we have to verify, do we have to convert that to dose to make a real comparison? Just a minor point, and this is shown in the report. If you have a laminated material embedded in the concrete, as I had indicated earlier, then the width of the laminate has to be at least 30 cm wider than the primary beam at the back edge of the laminate, wherever the laminate happens to be, whether it's in the front of the barrier or in the middle of the barrier. You always have to maintain that extra 30 cm. And this is also directly out of the report. If you're doing primary shielding the ceiling, is obviously where you have a fixed thickness here, and you have to resort to having a high-density material such as lead here with concrete filling the rest. You obviously don't want to fill the whole of the area with lead. It becomes too expensive and too heavy, so you have to start tapering the lead out towards the edges. And so you need to do calculations every certain number of degrees to calculate what the required thickness is, taking into account to the oblique thickness and also the extra distance. Note also that as you go out from isocenter towards the wall, the beam width increases also. I should also mention, of course, that in this case, if this is in the wall, then you have to take this width to be at the top of the wall, and likewise in the ceiling, it has to be the very edge of the ceiling because it's going to spread out as it's shown in this diagram here. This is something that Pat discovered in more recent times and is included in the report. So we call it ground shine. Basically, you have a concrete-free barrier which is considered contains lead and polyethylene to stop the high-energy photons and the neutrons, and it's relatively thin. But here, there's only a concrete floor, which is obviously a lower density material than this lead here, so rays can come down here and then scatter up here quite readily and go through a shorter path length and be less attenuated there. So it does need to make sure there's some perhaps additional lead or steel here to make sure that radiation is properly attenuated before scattering back up into the adjacent room. Okay, so let's look at some of the practical issues. We showed a diagram before of the lead in front of the concrete, so this will be a plan view of a wall where this will be the existing concrete, and the lead, we have some put some lead bricks here, which they're interlocking lead bricks, which makes it easy to put together, and these are held in place in securely with using a steel channel, which is bolted to the floor and the ceiling to make sure nothing happens. And so the beam is now pointing this direction, and that's a fairly straightforward technique, and one has to allow for an additional 3 inches or so for this extra stuff. So if the architect says you only have 48 inches to work with, apart from, say, the gypsum board, for example, and I mentioned 48 inches before, then you really should take off 3 inches to allow for this extra support structure, which does not add to the shielding. And so this shows the one of the walls that our friend did for us. This is the upgrade from the Cobalt 60 to the 4MV, and you can see two of the walls here from floor to ceiling because it needed lead almost everywhere. You can see the interlocking lead bricks, and you can see the vertical frames. And this shows another view of the same thing, just two adjacent walls there. For the ceiling, it's more complicated because it needs to be supported. So schematically here, we have the concrete in the ceiling, and we need to add all of this lead, or in some cases even polyethylene, depending on the energy, and it needs to be supported somehow. And this can be done using I-beams which span across the room, and they can be mounted above that. The problem with doing this technique is that this kind of maximizes the amount of space needed to support it, because this may only be 4 or 6 inches, but this could be 8 or 10 inches, and may even at the end of the edge of the room may need additional I-beams to support those transverse I-beams here. An alternative approach is essentially to put in the I-beams and then put steel plates between the webs of the I-beams, weld them in place, and then stack the lead above that, and polyethylene again if you need it. And this then minimizes the amount of space that's required for putting that all together. And this shows a photograph of such an arrangement. Can't see so well here. These are the cross I-beams. These are the steel plates. And you can see the lead bricks which have been stacked above there. In this particular case, we had this room. That room I mentioned to you is has half of the roof is outside the building and half is inside the building. So on the distal part, we're unable to put lead outside, so we put the lead beneath the ceiling. The other part, we have a crawl space between the top of the vault and the second floor, about 5 feet or so, and so we put the lead in that part for the rest of the room. And so what we had to do was we had to dig a hole, make a hole in the wall, and they found some gentlemen who are both strong and short who could lay all these lead bricks over this whole area, which was not easy. These steel I-beams, by the way, span the whole wall to support the additional lead there. They actually, actually attach through the thing to the other I-beams to hold them up. So it needs a great deal more support. So structural engineering is a major issue when doing retrofitting of ceiling shielding, because they have to worry about whether the extra lead can be supported, and if so, how it's going to be supported. That's always a great concern. This is the same thing, but it also shows this is the street level now. This is a patio above, and this is the earth behind here. There was no additional stuff there. But because this was the goes from the street level up to the edge of the patio, we needed lead here as well. So this is bolted behind this steel plate here. On another room, we had something similar to do. It's an adjacent room, actually, which is outside the building, and this is inside the building, and this is earth over here. This is a sidewalk over here. And when the room was first designed, it was actually Ted Webster who designed it. what he decided to do was to put a corner piece here to account for the radiation coming through in this direction here, which was just about above the street level. Well, that was fine, except that it made it more difficult to, when it came to retrofit, to attach the I-beams to this thing here, because there's not a vertical thing here where we could attach those I-beams. And so what's shown here is some bolts. It's shown more schematic, because they're much longer than in practice. There are four such bolts. And I was quite surprised when they told me, well, they're about 2 feet long, about 2 inches diameter, and they're held in place by glue. And these two I-beams with these 16 bolts is holding up about 100 tons of lead. And I thought, this is kind of surprising. And so I said, are you sure that's going to work? He says, oh, yeah, standard practice. It's not a problem. Then, of course, last year we had that incident in the Big Dig Tunnel when the ceiling tiles collapsed. What caused the ceiling tiles to collapse? Well, it was the glue that didn't hold up. Apparently they used the wrong glue. So I said, we better go back again and check this. So we had another check, and they assured us that this was the right glue and it was done properly. This shows those a picture of those two bolts here on one side and the two on the other side. Actually, there isn't one on the other side because that's... there is one on the other side. So there are a total of 16 bolts holding up the cross beams, which in turn hold up the lead. Moving on to another area. For low-energy machines, maze doors are constructed solely of lead and steel or wood. We don't need to worry about neutrons. And generally speaking, it's about a quarter of an inch of lead. But for high-energy machines, in addition to lead, neutrons have to be considered, and we always end up with some polyethylene, borated polyethylene, in the door. So we have a composite door for the, whether it's a maze door or a direct door. I'm not going to talk too much about it. That's the next first two lectures tomorrow. But suffice to say that for when you get to a high-energy machine, one doesn't seriously have to consider the scatter radiation that one considers at low energy, because the average energy of those photons when they hit the door is extremely low compared with the energy of the captured gamma rays which strike the door, which is could be several MeV. So for that reason, one generally only worries about the neutrons produced from the head scattering down the maze, and also captured gamma rays produced by the neutrons in the maze itself. And just to digress a little bit, I think we heard this morning somebody had said, well, this is a bad design because in their case, I think their primary beam was hitting the maze area somewhere. Well, guess what? We have two, in our old facility, we have two rooms like this. This was also partly because of space considerations. Now, here we have the primary beam striking the primary barrier here, and so scatter radiation comes down towards the maze, which is only about 3 meters away. Now, if you look up NCRP 151, as Raymond has says, they've very nicely tabulated the albedo factors, the alpha factors, for various types of incoming and scattering angles. So they have a table which lists for the case where the beam hits the wall orthogonally and scatters this way. But the largest angle is 75 degrees. So you thought, okay, you take that and do a calculation based on 75. But of course, you can have angles a great deal less than 75. And one of the problems is this is some graphs taken from Chilton's book, and this shows the alpha factor for cobalt 60 as a function of that angle. And you can see as the angle gets to a certain point, it drops very rapidly. So it's a very nebulous number when it gets to a large number. So it's kind of difficult to calculate that at that large angle. There may be other ways to do that. One thing we have done, and this has been done in conjunction with another problem we have, by doing a Monte Carlo. Now, our new building is built with a slurry wall. I'm not sure people know what a slurry wall is, but it's one of those things where they dig a big pit, dig trough in the ground, just pour the concrete in, then they dig the earth out afterwards. But one of the problems with slurry walls is it's a nice technology which was invented with the Big Dig. One of the problems with the slurry walls is it leaks water. And so you have to go in and plug water leaks all the time, which is great, as in our case, it's used for underground garage, it's not a problem. But when you have a radiotherapy department, you don't want water leaking out of the sidewalls. So what they insisted on having is an access passage, which is 3 feet wide, which goes around the whole facility. And I will show you a picture later on of the facility. You can see what I'm talking about. But now we have the problem that the main scattering wall does not go to the edge of the major walls, so there's a gap here of 3 feet. So we have to worry about scatter radiation coming here and also primary beam hitting this one and going over there. So this, apart from, is a kind of a complex calculation to do under the current methodology. You can do it, but you have to make some wide assumptions. So we decided we're going to do Monte Carlo work to see if we can back up those calculations. And so what we have done, this is the primary beam. We've got a multiple detectors. I only show two here, but there are about 10 detectors extending out several meters over here. So we were looking at the fluence of photons down this passageway here. And this shows those two cases, the spectrum for fluence of photons for the near detector, where you can see the high energy component still there. But after a few meters, this drops off quite rapidly. But still, the cross-sections, the attenuation, is still significant. It still takes a lot of material to stop it. And you can see this is for concrete, and this is for steel, and also for lead, in terms of depth of material. And if you look at the TVLs, the first TVL, I'm sorry, if you want to reduce it by 10 to the minus 4, you can see you'd need quite a bit of concrete if you're that far, that close. But when you get further away, this drops quite rapidly. But it needs, you can see that these are non-trivial numbers, and they have to be taken into account. This is quite, even 6 cm lead is quite a substantial amount of lead. And this shows the attenuation of the fluence down that narrow passage, which is bounded by concrete on both sides. And you can see it's quite it has quite a large TVD, a tenth value distance, a short TVD, sorry, over that range. So in addition to scatter and leakage, additional components come into play at energy greater than 10, greater or equal to 10 MeV. I think in the report we made less mention of 10 MeV because it was felt by many that there are no problems at 10 MeV, but certainly I, from my personal experience, have seen we have to take into account neutrons at 10 MeV. And again, it depends on what energy the machine is actually tuned up to. But one has to consider it, and there are published numbers on production of neutrons, and one should certainly take it into account. So when you get to the maze door, then we got worried about the neutrons and the captured gamma rays, and NCRP 151 recommends the following TVLs. For neutrons, is 4.5 cm of polyethylene, and the captured gamma rays is 6.1 cm of lead. Now, the 6.1 is a holdover from NCRP 49, and I've often wondered about that because if you look at the TVLs for the primary beams, they are maxed out about 5.8 cm, and I was kind of surprised it gets that high because if you look at the attenuation curve of photons in lead, it bottoms out around about 4 MeV or so. So if you've got higher energy, it's actually going to get less, not more. So it may be just a very conservative estimate rather than being a fairly realistic number. But it might be something that some graduate student might want to explore someday. We also looked at neutron production of captured gamma rays. We thought that would be an interesting thing to do. I have a student who's working on that. So we just took this passageway, and we had a neutron source, a very broad neutron source, with neutrons coming out at very large angles. And we had detectors all down the walls here, and we just looked at what was going on. And so we looked at the fluence as a function of distance along the maze, and we get the same kind of answer that people would expect to get that's published in NCRP 151 in the literature, about a TVD of about 5 meters. This is for neutrons, and this is for photons. This endpoint falling off is only due to the Monte Carlo because the problem's bounded at this point, so there's no backscatter here at all. But you can see there's a constant decline of that over many, many meters. And this is actually the captured gamma ray spectrum that we observe at one distance long, and it doesn't change very much with distance. But you can see it's a sharp peak of very low energies, but you can see the 2.2 MeV here and the various other energies which you can probably identify. The statistics are pretty good, but they could be improved, I think, to sharpen the energy of that thing there. Then if you do the attenuation of that, then you end up with the rather large TVL that's been claimed. So this is certainly of the right order of magnitude, but there's also a sharp drop up here as well, which is not inconsistent with what we talk about in the report with the two TVL solution. In terms of high energy doors, I've taken this directly from Pat McGinley's book. I'm not going to talk much about it, except say this is how this works. I only wanted to mention one other thing, that we refurbished a room, the one I showed you with the glued-in bolts. It was a 15 MeV machine. And we did the survey at the door, and we had when the beam was at 90 degrees gantry angle, which was when the head of the machine was closest to the door, we expected that would be the largest, the angular position, the gantry angle position, where we get the largest neutron background. It turned out it was somewhat larger when the beam was pointed towards the ceiling. We weren't quite sure why, and then we realized that we just put in all this lead and steel up there, and it covered the whole ceiling. So the primary beam was very close to the ceiling, so we kind of surmised that the photons hitting the ceiling was producing some additional neutrons in addition to those produced from the head itself, and so that more than compensated for the different distance from the door. But it's an interesting concept, and one should worry about things like that. I want to talk about heavy door requirements because these are essential things to worry about. First of all electrical electronic equipment should be accessed from the outside of the room, so if something fails, then you can get at it. You don't want to think the electronic control circuits and everything else inside the room. That would be very bad. In case there's a problem, let's say there's a mechanical failure or an electrical failure that you can't solve, then you need to have a come-along to open the door mechanically. But then this makes sure when you do the design of the room, you need to have a bolt hole in the door and a bolt in the concrete sidewall. But if the door, in most cases these days, if the door gets stuck, it's stuck on the tracks. And it's only a question of finding the right solution to the problem, whether it's electrical or mechanical, and you can ease it open in some way or another. But what happens if it actually fails in the closed position and it's actually on the floor, which is unlikely to happen, but what would you do? Now, the doors that we had were designed about 30 years ago by a company that wasn't specialized in therapy rooms, and the design of the support system wasn't the best in the world and was prone to wear and tear, and this could possibly have happened. In fact, I recall at least one event where we did have to use our so-called escape hatch. But in the current design, I think it's probably unlikely that one would need it, but in case one decides that this is a good thing to do, then this is what you would have to do. So here, first of all, is a come-along here so that the door sticks. You can tension this chain here and ease the door open to get into the room. Again, we're worried about the patient being in the room at the time of the failure. So if we build an escape hatch, this is an alternative access into and out of the room. We need to be concerned about various things. One is for low energy rooms, we just need lead only. And we just have two doors which with thickness equivalent to the local wall thickness, as you would expect. Or you can have a passageway if you want to. You have enough room in the facility, you can have a passageway. But most rooms don't allow that kind, or most facilities don't have that kind of space. If you go to high energy, then of course you need probably extra polyethylene. And so that adds up to the thickness. Most importantly, the doors must be interlocked to the general door interlocked of the Linac to ensure that if open, the door, the beam will automatically cut off. I don't think you'll find that happens very often, but it's very important because after all, if you open all the doors and you can look into the room with the beam on, that wouldn't be a good idea. This shows one of the escape hatches we still have. This is the original one that I think Ted Webb's designed. It actually consists of two layers of 3-inch steel blocks. Steel, I guess, is because they get in and out easily without being damaged, but that's what he designed. But since we upgraded from 10 MV with a beam stopper to a 15 MV, we decided to add some polyethylene, so we have these extra doors here. Now, it looks like this thing, I can show another view on the other side where it's closed, and it looks like this thing is just swinging on these pieces of wood here, but that's not the case, because behind this wooden slats, there are two extraordinarily heavy I-beams which support this whole structure here. So it's a non-trivial thing if you have you're shielding for a high-energy machine. You have a lot of material, and it weighs a lot, and it's going to cover a reasonably large area for a person to be able to get into the room. But as I say, generally speaking, these are not the kinds of things you need to have to worry about, but if you do, this is what you have to do. And I just thought I'd end on something completely different. We heard in the report on 147 yesterday, we heard about the issue of source constraints and how that was overcome, and I think Ray mentioned that also this morning. But we also heard from the PET talks where there was a need to consider multiple sources. So you might have the patient, there's a patient's on the table, there's another patient in the holding area, and there's the injection lab. So anybody who's working in that area can be subject to three types of sources. So this is contrast to the concept of source constraints in diagnostic radiology in general. In radiation therapy, the need sometimes arises to consider the same situation. So this shows a planned view of our new facility. And I should make a few introductory remarks based on comments made this morning by Dan and Mark, because we followed the same path they did almost exactly, and it worked out quite well. But the problem was that we had asked for a certain amount of square footage, and we actually got a certain amount less. And then the architects came and said, well, you can't have so much space because we need to put in this slurry wall and all this stuff around here. So you can see there's a 3-foot wall which goes around the whole facility, around the outside. That's lose a lot of square footage. So all these Linacs here have a slurry wall around the back, and there are two entrance doors, one up here, not shown, and one down here, and there's one further over here outside the Linac area. So we got squeezed from the western side, and then the people here expanded somewhat, and we got squeezed from the east side, so we got pushed together on this. And I think my feeling is that I think the need for an adequate design for the Linac rooms was not properly taken into account. I think they didn't appreciate and realize that we needed more space to do a nice job. As a result, we end up with a lot of heavy doors and mini mazes and things like that, and less access to the room. For example, you can see here there's a I-beam here, right here, which is very, very unfortunate. We end up putting a little maze wall here to cover that and use its usefulness. But there's one over here too, which restricted where we could put the machine in the room. At that point, the footprint of the building had been designed, and we weren't left with much choice because the rest of the area was programmed for the flow that Dan had talked about earlier. We had to have this over here because this is how the patients come in on the east side, and they'll flow down through the procedures, the CTs, and so forth, and go on further on. And it turned out that we then found we got even less space than we wanted. We ended up moving all of the imaging part of the oncology department back to the existing building, keeping that separate from the treatment area. So we lost even more space, and we ended up with a divided department. And that was about the best we could do. But in any case, what I wanted to say was that we have these 8 machines here, and they're lined up, as somebody had mentioned this morning, with the primary beams pointing towards the joint barriers here. And so these are the 8 machines there in their rooms. And these correspond to control areas where it's controlling one machine. So this one controls room number eight, and this controls room number 3. And these control 2 Linacs. This one controls this one and this one. This controls 5 and 4, and this controls 1 and 2. So we have multiple areas and jointly controlled. Now you can see that it's a very compact area. And what you see is that somebody sitting into this area is subject to radiation from 4 different Linacs over here. Likewise, in this double one here, there's subject to radiation from 3 machines over here. Granted, somewhat less here, but one has to consider it. And ditto down here. So these are considerations we do have to take into account. And you can also see that they can get radiation inside the room, because once they're in, they're getting the primary beam from the other side, so one has to be sure about that. But these all interrelate, and one has to then calculate p-values, which are appropriate for a therapist working in this area, subject to these, then moving and working in that room. And ditto down here, you can see also the same effect. Since they're all in line, that's going to be true for all of the Linacs. So in summary, laminated barriers are commonly used to upgrade radiation therapy rooms, and also a new construction where space is limited. The methodology of handling laminated barriers is straightforward to low energies, but requires careful consideration of neutrons and captured gamma rays for high energies involves iterative calculations. I'd like to thank my colleagues for helping with some of these calculations of various things in this report, and I'd like to thank for your attention. And I think if Herb Moore is still around, he'll recognize his alma mater here on the right-hand side. Thank you.